I'm Matthew Smith, Vermont Edition producer, and I wanted to let you know that the podcast you're about to listen to has been edited for clarity and brevity. Thanks for listening and enjoy.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. It's the end of the first week in June, and there's still no resolution to the stalemate between Republican Governor Phil Scott and Democratic leaders at the State House over property tax rates. This week, the state's projected budget surplus grew by another $10 million, and the Scott administration say these numbers show that there's enough money to reduce property tax rates and meet the obligations of the Vermont State Teachers Pension Fund. Governor Scott's chief of staff, Jason Gibbs, says there's no question the governor will veto a new budget if the Senate adopts it this week.
The budget as proposed is effectively the same as the one that the governor's vetoed, in that it still contains a major area of disagreement. They're using every legislative maneuver and trick that they can think of to try to raise rates in a year when we have $160 million more in revenue than we did last year.
So is it appropriate to use this surplus money to lower property tax rate? And if it's not, how does this stalemate ever get resolved? These are some of the questions we have for our guest today, Senate President Tim Ash. Tim, welcome back to Vermont Edition.
Thanks for having me, Bob.
So the House earlier this week, Tim, gave its approval to a state budget for next year. The proposal does not include the provisions on how to spend the roughly $34 million in one-time surplus money. House leaders say the goal is to ensure that there isn't a shutdown of state government on July 1st. Governor says he's going to veto that budget proposal if the Senate gives approval to it this week. So what's your plan for this Senate bill?
Well, we reviewed the House bill, and I'll just briefly describe what it does. It effectively passes the same budget that unanimously passed the Senate. It received votes from the most fiscally conservative and fiscally liberal members of the Senate. It was nearly unanimous in the House. It includes $30 million in income tax reductions, which would have inadvertently hit Vermonters as a result of the federal tax change. It dramatically reduces taxation of Social Security income for retirees. And it creates a default residential tax rate, which is what the governor wants. So right now, what's in the bill that's going to be acted on this afternoon in the Senate, there is nothing in it the governor disagrees with. So we believe that we should pass this, get it to the governor's desk. Governor signs it into law, then we can fight about the remaining areas of dispute, of which, frankly, there are not many. So the governor's chief of staff can say all he wants. These aren't legislative tricks. What we're trying to do is avert a government shutdown, which the governor has spoken rather cavalierly about.
When you say that there's a default residential property tax rate, what do you mean?
Well, in law today, there is no default residential tax rate for residential properties if the legislature doesn't make a different policy in law in a given year. So this would establish the residential tax rate moving forward as a default at what it was last year, which is what the governor wants. And then it would require the legislature to make a decision each year about what to do. The rate that we're proposing is exactly what the governor wants. And he wants it for the next 5 years, in fact, which would be actually a dramatic tax increase on residential property taxpayers. But it would create a default setting so that we don't have these brinksmanships in the future, and allows government to stay open as well as our schools.
So the governor's office would argue that this budget bill is really not one that doesn't contain any controversial issues, because they would say the default on the non-residential rate. Now, under state law, if there isn't an education bill passed, then the non-residential rate automatically reverts back to what it was last year. So they see that as a tax increase. And here's Jason Gibbs explaining that.
And as a result, would put them in the position of being able to delay the negotiation on non-residential property tax rates to the point of July 1st when it would automatically increase.
What do you say to that?
Well, I'm not going to respond directly to Mr. Gibbs, who has actually done the unprecedented thing of attacking nonpartisan fiscal analysts. The governor actually had to apologize for Mr. Gibbs's behavior. And then just earlier this week, Mr. Gibbs once again attacked our joint fiscal office, the nonpartisan, unbiased analysts who legislators count on for just the facts, which means either the governor has authorized this continued assault on a trusted nonpartisan group, or Mr. Gibbs has gone rogue. Either way, it's unacceptable, and the governor has to put a stop to it. But the governor's office has also sent out press releases, and they coordinate this with the governor's campaign. It's almost indistinguishable at this point, saying that the bill before the legislature raises property taxes. They can say it one time. They can say it 10 times. They can say it 100 times. It's still nonsense. The fact that a governor's office is putting out information which is not true really is not the way Vermont governors have been counted on to lead in this state. Yes, the bill does reserve the debate over what to do with one-time money in the non-residential tax rate for a second bill. What we're saying is, let's completely eliminate the specter of a government shutdown and the calamitous effects that would have on Vermonters, and then move on and fight over the last few details.
So I want to make sure I understand this. Their argument is, let's say you pass this budget and you avoid a government shutdown. You're still going to have to negotiate over the $34 million.
That's correct.
And their argument is that if you don't make an honest effort to negotiate over that, then on July 1st, the non-residential rate is automatically going to go up, which is what you would like to see happen.
Well, legislative leaders have indicated they will come to the table, and they have said it publicly. So what the governor's office is effectively saying is, we don't trust the legislature. And it's not just the majority leadership, as they keep saying in their press releases. It's the entire legislature, because in the intro to the show, you said the governor is at odds with the majority party in Montpelier. The governor is at odds with virtually every member of the legislature. The budget passed unanimously in the Senate. The tax bill was co-authored and supported by Randy Brock, one of the most fiscally conservative members of the Senate. These passed with near unanimous votes on every major issue this year. So the trust in the legislature amongst people who are Democrats, Republicans, progressives is very strong. The people who are impugning the integrity of others are those on the fifth floor, the governor's office. And so the idea that they would say that we can't be trusted to come to the table in good faith, when in fact the only party at this point who has refused to entertain any compromise whatsoever is the governor's office. The bill we have includes a tax rate for residential properties the governor wants. We're already showing our willingness to compromise. It's only Governor Gibbs and his direction of the governor's office that is leading to these sort of claims of, you know, the legislature will walk and they won't, you know, play ball.
So this is what I hear from the administration. Here's a simple solution to this problem. Just in your budget, include a one-year waiver of the law that automatically reverts that non-residential rate. Take that off the table. And then they say you can have full and meaningful negotiations.
Well, at that point, the administration is saying, if you adopt our position in its entirety, we will then sit down with you. And that is just not the way negotiations occur. Like it or not, we have a government structure with co-equal branches of government. And if the governor came in on the first day of the legislative session and put a piece of paper down and says, this is a bill, a draft bill, and if you pass anything that doesn't look exactly like this, I'm going to veto it. That would be a complete betrayal of co-equal branches of government. So the legislature right now, sometimes we're asked, well, if the governor might veto this, why are you moving forward? Well, the legislature, and this is not just the majority party, our job is to do what we believe is the right thing to do, not the politically expedient thing to do, as the governor's advisors are suggesting. It is to do the right thing. That is why we have had enormous unanimous votes on every single issue we've worked on, because of the trust we've built in amongst ourselves. But just you just mentioned a government shutdown. Just think about this. When I was in high school, Newt Gingrich was the Speaker of the House. He was willing to shut down the federal government in order to push through extremist policies that were very unpopular with the American people. Donald Trump, our president, talks almost excitedly about shutting down government to get his stupid wall built. Now, for the second year in a row, Governor Scott and his team are literally threatening a government shutdown to force through ideas, education ideas, which have been trashed by the superintendents, the school boards, the teachers, and any other nonpartisan observer. So the idea that we are now going to normalize government shutdowns as a way of forcing through proposals that not only don't have legislative support, but don't have support from anyone who actually is out in the field. And I think it's telling that those pitching these ideas from the administration actually have no background in education issues. They're individuals who have a political background, but we're not hearing from the education professionals standing behind these issues, I think because it's hard for them to do so.
So let's just see what's going to happen. The Senate is likely to pass the budget, send it to the governor. He says he's going to veto it. Do you have the votes in the Senate to override a veto?
I believe we do. Yes.
And then the question would be in the House, and that's really an open question over there.
Yep, it's a much more gray question for sure. And you know, one of the real tests here. I take great pride as the leader of the Senate that our bills, the major money bills, are passing unanimously. It means that all parties have come together around common objectives and believe that a fair outcome has been arrived at. What we saw in the House last week was, for the first time really all year on a substantial major issue, was pure partisan behavior by the House Republicans, many of whom are now voting against entire provisions that they voted for just 1.5 or 2 months ago. To me, if the governor vetoes this, and I sincerely hope he does not, there is no thing in the bill that he does not support, that if he vetoes the bill, I would hope that people would summon the courage to do the right thing and not merely step up to throw some political support for their governor.
And what you're speaking about is when the budget originally passed in the House, it passed with very strong Republican support.
Virtually unanimous. I think a handful stood up and opposed it. As I understand it, the governor's office actually asked a few Republicans so that it would not be unanimous.
Let's go to our callers and talk to Julie, who is calling from Mallets Bay. Hi, Julie. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Thank you. One quick comment and then one quick question, which is I am in absolute disbelief that Phil Scott, who promised that he was not going to be like a Scott Walker or other much more hardline conservative Republican governors, has basically gone back on his promise, is pulling the same old tactics out of the Trumpian GOP playbook. I know several independents who supported Phil Scott in his initial election, but have said no way for 2018 in re-election for him. But my question for Tim Ash is this all, like, I get the sense that this is a Jason Gibbs ride or die all the way to the Alamo type thing. I would have thought he would have learned his lesson after last year, but is there like some sort of magical thing that none of us have figured out that Phil Scott and Jason Gibbs are actually holding out for, or are they just being contemptuous to be contemptuous?
Okay, Julie, thanks for your phone call.
Well, Julie, I can't get in the heads of either Governor Scott or the Chief of Staff, Jason Gibbs. I think Aki Soga, who's a longtime journalist at the Free Press, put it pretty well when he said, Governor Phil Scott's education financing plan bears the hallmark of the classic GOP starve the beast play for downsizing government. And what I believe Aki meant when he said that was that by using this one-time money, so the governor says we have this additional money coming in through income taxes, I want to point that out, that we can move that over and on a one-year basis fill some of the education fund to pay for the school budgets that were passed overwhelmingly on town meeting day. What happens next year is that because that money is of a one-time nature, it's not there to use again to pay those education expenses. So then next year we have another manufactured, self-inflicted funding crisis for education. Then there is another logic for the administration to propose even more aggressive education policies, which are not popular with the public, including mandatory staff cuts at virtually every school in the state and possibly Montpelier telling school districts that they have to close facilities. So the pattern of starving the education fund by using this one-time money, make no mistake about it, from a purely electoral point of view, the governor will say, I'm saying no new taxes. Well, the voters asked to spend this money, and by diverting other funds to help pay the education costs, what it means is next year we're in exactly the same pickle. And this is why Governor Scott, when he campaigned for the office, himself said that we needed to stop using one-time money to pay for ongoing expenses. The minority leader, Don Turner, has railed against the legislative majority over the years for the exact same thing. Even John McLowery, the longtime leader of the Ethan Allen Institute, a conservative think tank, a former employee of Ronald Reagan, has described the legislative majority, and I would correct him and say the legislature, of having the financial high ground on this, being the financially responsible party here. It's almost like being in a conservative twilight zone in a way, where it's the legislature that is often accused of not finding a program it doesn't want to spend on, who are actually being the fiscally conservative ones.
Let's talk to Steve, calling from Montpelier. Hi, Steve. Welcome to the program.
Hi there. Hi, this is Steve Howard. I just want to say, you know, I represent the state employees who really want to applaud Senator Ash and Speaker Johnson for standing their ground. You know, I talk to state employees every day who are tired of being used as pawns in the governor's game, and we really appreciate the fact that they have legislators who are willing to try to do everything they can to avoid this shutdown. This has real impacts on people who live paycheck to paycheck and are wondering if they're going to be told someday that they don't have a job to go to, all to score political points. And I think Senator Ash and Speaker Johnson should be applauded for standing their ground on this issue.
Okay, Steve, thanks very much for your phone call. Let's talk to Jason in St. Johnsbury. Hi, Jason. Welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me. How are you?
Great.
So I was an educator for 14 years, and I have a two-part question, I guess. The first would be, why is it seems like year after year, Vermont keeps, for lack of a better term, banging its head against the wall over the educational funding issue? And what do you think at this point it would take to get enough votes to overcome a governor's veto?
Well, Jason, the question of why we keep finding ourselves in this position is a complicated one. I'd say the most immediate one and most relevant for the dispute we have with the governor right now is that each year when we politicize the raising of the funds to pay for education, we usually try to play little accounting gimmicks. And if you artificially raise or lower education tax rates, it means that reality comes due the following year. And so last year, when the governor also threatened to shut down government if he didn't get his way on education issues, we, in a compromise in order to get out of Montpelier and keep government open and the schools operating, we had to use one-time money. And so a good portion of what was anticipated of spending increases this year was catching up with the use of one-time money last year. So each time you use one-time money and don't let the system pay for itself, it means that you just perpetuate this problem. And as I say, those who actually have no interest in a strong, healthy public school system are delighted at the perception that there is an ongoing funding crisis. The real nut of it is that several years ago, the legislature passed Act 46. It is not unanimously popular throughout the state, but it was the result of many years of work to try and make a system which was really based on the 19th century appropriate for the 21st century and bring districts together where it made sense for more efficient management of our schools, more efficient use of our personnel, and better educational opportunities for kids. We're in like year three of what really is almost a decade-long approach to transforming our public school system. We're starting to see both the improved opportunities for kids in schools that maybe didn't have as much programming in the past. We're also seeing savings starting to occur. So I think we're going to see a restrained rate of growth in school spending in the future as a result of that law. We're already seeing it pay off. And unfortunately, much of the discussion coming out of the governor's office actually risks the progress we're making through that law.
So if the governor was here, he would say that your description that what he's doing is using one-time money for ongoing programs in state government, he'd say, no, you have it all wrong. That's not what he's doing. He would say he's borrowing that money this year. He has a five-year plan to reduce education costs. It could be done through larger student-staff ratios. It could be done through a statewide health care contract for all staff. There'd be changes to special education, maybe tougher excess spending thresholds, some of the savings, as you mentioned, through Act 46. So he says he's not spending the money. He's borrowing it. And he's confident that if you implement these cost containment measures, that he'll be able to pay the money back.
Well, Bob, Governor Scott can say that, and along with his team in the fifth floor in the governor's office, that would make them the only people in Vermont who believe that statement.
You don't think there could be some savings if you change the student-staff ratio?
There will be savings if you mandate student-to-teacher ratios, student-to-staff ratios. If you mandate it out of Montpelier using a one-size-fits-all approach, you could guarantee savings. The governor floated that for 1.5 days and then retreated because it didn't find a single receptive ear in the state of Vermont. So now what the governor's doing is the following. He's using the logic you just recited from him. He says, we're going to save $262 million in the next 5 years through reduced personnel expenses. And then people say, well, how are you going to do that, Governor? And then there's no answer. If you don't mandate headcount cuts at every school in the state, you can't save the money. So on the one hand, he's saying it won't be mandatory ratios, but then he's booking all the savings, which can only be achieved through mandatory ratios. Another instance, he believes that we will save $83 million or $85 million a year on a special education law, which I should note was initiated by the legislature, not the administration. The legislature agrees that over time, this law will likely reduce special education spending, which is a good thing. However, not one expert, including the authors of those reports, believe we'll see the savings in years 1, 2, 3, or maybe even 4 or 5. The governor's booking those in the first 5 years, $83+ million. The governor says we're going to increase penalties for districts that spend more than a particular amount per student. However, the Joint Fiscal Office, which is the nonpartisan analyst that the governor's chief of staff has attacked in an unprecedented fashion, I should add, have said that the proposal has no details to it. It double counts savings that appear in other things the governor says he's going to do to restrain costs. So there's no integrity to the proposal itself. So to say you're going to borrow the money this year, you know, this one-time money is borrowing it, and you're going to pay it back with savings that not a single person outside the governor's office is willing to book in the manner the governor's doing, would be like letting someone take out a loan because they say they might get a job which will allow them to pay it back. That's not how banks operate. It's not how the legislature should operate. It's not how the governor should propose legislation.
Let's talk to Laura, who is calling from Guilford. Hi, Laura. Welcome to the program.
Talking about the one-time money only in terms of education, I agree that I haven't been there every day to hear all the suggestions. But instead of that, has anybody talked about spending on infrastructure, which would last for a long time and would not have to be paid back next year?
Well, what the legislature did propose to do in a bipartisan fashion was take this additional money, which is only going to appear on the bottom line this coming year, and pay down long-term debt, which is what most households or businesses would do. They get a one-time windfall of cash. They pay down a long-term debt or something of a one-time nature. The $35 million that the legislature was putting down to pay down our long-term teacher obligations, retirement obligations, would save over a 20-year period approximately $100 million. There is no dispute about the facts. There are other options. So, Bob, as you began the show, you mentioned that it looks like there might be an additional $10 million that comes in this year. That money could be used for water quality projects, which, of course, the governor has opposed putting more money into water quality pollution fighting. It could go into additional housing infrastructure. It could go into transportation projects. It could go into any number of projects of a more one-time nature. And, in fact, under all previous governors, that's precisely how we would be talking about using these additional funds. It is only in this effort to force through education policies that we're seeing this desire, almost compulsion to try to do bad fiscal budgeting in order to push through proposals of a completely unrelated nature.
Now, the House Ways and Means Committee is looking at the possibility, are there other ways to return this money to taxpayers? So don't necessarily spend it because you don't want to use it for ongoing programs, but maybe there's a one-time way to reward taxpayers. You know, you could maybe use the income tax or it's been done in the past of a rebate or a tax credit. Is something like that on the table?
Well, it would certainly be more appropriate. So for those listening who might be less familiar, this additional money that was unexpected or unanticipated really comes from two sources. One, from a tobacco settlement that the Attorney General's office had with a bunch of tobacco companies. That was many years in the works, and it was $30+ million, which are coming to Vermont. The second source of money is the unintended byproduct of the federal tax law that passed earlier this year. So a number of businesses have, many of whom have barely any presence in Vermont, have returned money from overseas back into the United States to get favorable tax treatment. But that's resulting in more tax collections in states all across the country. So, and then some of the money is also coming from individual income taxpayers in Vermont as a result of federal tax changes. So if you were going to do a direct return of these dollars to taxpayers. It would be far more appropriate if you were going to do it that way to go through the income tax system so that you've got income taxpayers getting their own money back in some fashion. The dilemma with what the governor's proposing, if it were to go into effect, is you would effectively be taking Vermonters' income taxes and then distributing it back through education taxes, some of which indeed do go to those same Vermonters, some of which go to out-of-staters who own a second home, some of which go to businesses who have just received massive tax benefits from the federal government. So it's a less direct relationship. So could it be part of a discussion moving forward? For sure. The primary objective right now of the legislature, though, is to put the whole idea of a government shutdown behind us once and for all, and we hope the governor will sign that bill.
Let's talk to Carrie, who's calling from Vernon. Hi, Carrie. What's on your mind today?
Hi there, Rob. Oh, what's on my mind today? Well, property taxes. I live in the beautiful little town of Vernon, Vermont, and we recently had our nuclear power plant shut down here, which has, in effect, doubled my property taxes. Also, several years ago, we were declared a gold town, and our property taxes were raised then to kick in our contribution to the education for the rest of the state. They didn't think we were paying enough because we were getting money from Vermont Yankee. I think, if my understanding is correct, that Governor Scott wants to put a halt on the increase in property taxes for residents, Vermont residents, and I'm all for that. You know, where does it end as far as our taxes going up? Pretty soon we won't be able to afford to live here, and we don't even have a gas station in my town. We have one little elementary school. And I was just wondering, am I incorrect, or am I going to be looking at higher property taxes again?
Well, Carrie, the legislature has in the bill that is being discussed that we are very hopeful the governor will sign to keep government open, keeps the residential tax rate exactly the same as it was last year, which is the governor's position as well. So for homeowners, they would be no different under the bill that is before the legislature today that we're hoping to send to the governor's desk within a matter of days or a week. But I should point out that local school spending decisions affect the tax rates at the local level. And so under the governor's own plan, despite the simplicity of the bumper sticker slogan of no new taxes, 127 school districts will actually see their local tax rates go up. That's a story for another time, I suppose. But the legislature's position on the residential tax rate is indistinguishable at this point from the governor's. And so on that front, I hope that gives you some comfort.
So walk me through here what's going to happen. The Senate is going to pass this budget. There'll be a strong vote in the Senate in favor of the budget. You're going to send it to the governor. He's going to veto it. It's going to come back.
He may veto it, Bob.
He may veto it.
He shouldn't veto it, but he might.
He says he will.
Well, I'm not sure he knows what's in the bill, but when he does, I would hope he would sign this bill because otherwise it's hard to understand why he would not sign it. There's nothing, as I've said, in it that he does not support.
So he's indicated that he will veto this bill. It comes back to the legislature. You can override the veto in the Senate. Overriding in the House is much less likely. Where are we then? You say that, you know, you don't want a government shutdown, but aren't we on a path to a shutdown the way things are unfolding right now?
Well, I hope not. I mean, a government shutdown would be calamitous for the state, a huge embarrassment, risk our bond rating, disrupt the lives of not just the people who work for the state or receive payments for nonprofit agencies and hospitals and doctor's offices that receive a substantial amount of public dollars. But I would reframe the question here because the legislature and the governor are entitled to their respective positions. And under normal times, governors of both parties, when the legislative session's nearing its end, the fights have all been had, the disputes are now narrowed to a small number, and both sides accept some compromise and move on. That's what Governor Douglas, I believe, used to call the Vermont way, and I think Governor Shumlin operated very similarly. What we have now is a situation where the legislature has made substantial movement in the direction of the governor, not unlike last year. But what's different this time, the governor has not moved an inch. And so the talk about a government shutdown is not something the legislature entertains at all. The governor is the one who has to respond to why he would allow a government shutdown for a bill that has nothing in it he disapproves of.
If there is a government shutdown, do you think the legislature is blameless?
We are going to do everything possible to avoid a government shutdown. I think the Speaker and I have been very clear about that. Where the blame lies is for others to judge. Where the political fallout lands is for others to judge. What I do know is, on behalf of the Senate, we have stepped up and come midpoint between the governor's position and the legislature's position. The governor is still at the original goal line and hasn't moved at all. And so we hope that the governor will show gubernatorial leadership, which is what's expected of him, and actually show some compromise. This is not a one branch of government state where the governor gets to make a dictate and everyone else has to fall in line. The governor has to work with the legislature. He speaks frequently of how Vermont voters elected divided government, a Republican governor with Democratic majority in the legislature. And he says we have to recognize that in looking at his proposals. And we're saying you got to do the same, Governor.
Let's get a quick call in from David in St. Johnsbury. David, are you there?
Yes, thank you.
Oh, great. What's on your mind?
Well, this may have been answered, but my question is a simple one, or maybe simplistic. Given the near unanimous support for the budget, why not just override the veto?
Well, David, I wish I could snap my fingers and make it happen just like that. Members of the House Minority Party until recently had supported the budget and tax bill, and in recent days have decided to follow, get in lockstep with the governor, at least initially. And so if it comes to that, I hope that House members of all parties will say, let's do the right thing and not take orders from the governor's office and his political team and move on, get government running on July 1st. And pass, frankly, a responsible education financing plan, which was supported by some of the most conservative members of the legislature and the most liberal ones.
We'll certainly be following this issue in the coming days and certainly into next week. Many thanks to our guest today, Senate President Tim Ash. We really appreciate you coming by.
Thank you, Bob.